Bienvenidos, and welcome to the next installment of Lead Media Programming. From Studio 54, campus of California State University, San Bernardino, the digital media platform for inspired educators, leaders, and community activists and advocates taking our message directly to the people, to the gente. Thank you for sharing our common interest in the analysis, discussion, critique, dissemination, and commitment to the educational issues that impact Latinos. I'm your host, Dr. Enrique Murillo Jr., and this episode is a syndicated replay from season 3 of LEAD Summit 2012. The theme for the 2012 LEAD Summit, sustaining, replicating, and bringing up to scale those programs that work for Latino youth, was of particular importance because the Latino population was large, growing, and relatively young, but had lower educational achievement than other groups in the nation. It was particularly imperative to identify and catalog those programs across the United States that showed evidence of increasing the access, opportunity, and achievement gaps for Latino students. This session featured an opening keynote by Dr. Eduardo M. Ochoa, then Assistant Secretary for Post-Secondary Education, followed up with a youth panel comprised of LEAD Education Project's students. President Barack Obama named Eduardo M. Ochoa Assistant Secretary for Post-Secondary Education in 2010, where he served as the Secretary's chief advisor on higher education issues and administered more than 60 programs, totaling nearly $3 billion annually, that are designed to provide financial assistance to eligible students enrolled in post-secondary institutions. Continue and enjoy the full value and complexity of this episode. We extend our appreciation to all our LEAD sponsors and partners, planners, volunteers, speakers and panelists, production team, affiliates and town hall chapters, and commend them all for lifting their voice and uplifting the plight of Latinos in education. Thank you, gracias, Tlazo Kamate. Next, we have Edwin Gomez, who will moderate our morning keynote address. Edwin Gomez is the Administrative Director of Elementary Instruction for the San Bernardino City Unified School District and is a doctoral candidate in educational leadership in the Educational Leadership Program here at CSUSB. Thank you. All yours, Edwin.
Good morning. Buenos dias to everyone. I do want to echo what our previous speakers have said this morning. It is truly exciting to see the responses, to see the enthusiasm, to see the many people that are here this morning to support our educational issues that are facing our Latino community. And it's also amazing to see the people that are gathered here this morning, the people that are online, truly showing the passion, having the common denominator to provide the best education for our students. So with that, I'm honored and I'm privileged to be a moderator this morning. This morning, before I introduce our keynote speaker, I do want to introduce our student panel. I'm going to begin with Christian Diaz, Lupita Riesta, Carlo Ludwig, Maritza Morales. Let's give our student panel a round of applause, please. Now, at this time, I will give some background information on our keynote speaker. President Barack Obama named Eduardo M. Ochoa Assistant Secretary for Post-Secondary Education on February 23, 2010. He was confirmed by the U.S. Senate on June 22nd of that year, and in his post, he serves as the Secretary's chief advisor on higher education issues and administers more than 60 programs, totaling nearly $3 billion annually that are designed to provide financial assistance to eligible students enrolled in post-secondary institutions. The Education Department's Office of Post-Secondary Education, otherwise known as OPE, supports higher education facilities and programs through financial support to eligible institutions, recruits and prepares disadvantaged students for successful completion of college, promotes the study of foreign languages, and international affairs. Notable among its areas of oversight are the 8 TRIO programs, institutional development for minority institutions, teacher development, and the Fund for Improvement of Post-Secondary Education. OPE runs the well-known Bird, Fulbright, Javits, and McNair programs. A native of Buenos Aires, Dr. Ochoa attended bilingual schools in the Argentinian capital through his sophomore year in high school before immigrating with his family to Portland, Oregon, where his father, a biochemist, had been hired to run the clinical lab at Portland's Good Samaritan Hospital. Prior to joining the department, Dr. Ochoa served for 7 years as the provost and vice president for academic affairs at Sonoma State University, part of the California State University system. Please help me in welcoming the Assistant Secretary of Education for Post-Secondary Education, Dr. Eduardo Ochoa.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. You just heard from my boss, Arne Duncan, and he pretty much gave my speech. He was very, very concisely, really delivered a number of important points, and I will probably end up reiterating some of them. But I want to start by, first of all, congratulating Enrique Murillo for the fantastic work he's been doing in developing this conference, this LEAD conference. Where are you, Enrique? As I sat there listening to the way this conference has developed, the fact that now it's going out to dozens of countries and 1,500 sites, it's really become a global conference, and it's just it has tremendous potential. Really, I was thinking it could even start playing a role in our country's soft diplomacy. And helping build bridges to Latin America. This is something that I, you know, now I'm not speaking as a member of the administration, but just my personal opinion. As a country, we have neglected our relationship with Latin America. I think that it is an opportunity that we can't miss. Other emerging countries in the world are very active in Latin America. We don't take advantage of this opportunity at our peril. So I think that perhaps, you know, in an important way, by developing linkages with educational institutions, we can help foster that soft diplomacy that Secretary Clinton has spoken of often. I also want to congratulate President R. Carnegie for the outstanding work that this university has been doing. As I sat there amazed at some of the statistics that he mentioned, the fact that this campus has no achievement gap whatsoever between Latino students and the rest of the student population is astounding. We've known in theory that, theoretically, that it wasn't a mystery what needed to happen, but to actually see an institution that does it, it's quite remarkable, and it's really, I think, a model for not only California, but for the country. Another thing that just floored me was to hear that this institution, all of its student body, Latinos and others, are in the 92nd percentile of CLA gains. Now, that's a little technical thing. Let me explain. This collegiate learning assessment test is a very, very high-profile test. It has been receiving a lot of attention in Washington and policymakers. Recently, there was a book that came out called Academically Adrift, which has caused quite a stir in Washington and in policy circles because it showed that at least 35% of undergraduates in the schools that were surveyed that had been taking that test showed absolutely no gain in critical thinking skills at all between freshman and senior level. So, you know, the policymakers start saying, well, what are we getting for our money? What is the government getting for its $150 billion a year that it gives out in financial aid if so many students aren't learning anything? So to have Cal State San Bernardino make these substantial gains in the critical thinking skills, the general educational outcomes that are really going to be the lasting value that you receive from your higher education is really very remarkable. And I think that, you know, we should have people from the Chancellor's office and Sacramento poring over this campus to figure out what it is that you're doing that's working. and to replicate it as quickly as possible. In fact, Secretary Duncan mentioned that one of the proposals in the President's 2013 budget is a race to the top for higher education. And this actually is going to be a program starting in the first year, $1 billion that will be open to competitive bids by states. States who commit themselves to undertake a number of reform measures designed to increase completion rates to provide greater access and success for disadvantaged groups and generally help with the overall education agenda. So I think that I hope California applies, and I hope that if the state does, that they take a very close look at what is going on in this campus and develop proposals to emulate and bring to scale across the state the practices that San Bernardino is engaged in. So now let me back up a little bit and sort of start from the bigger picture and zero in on something that's going to connect then to a point that Ernie Garcia, Dr. Garcia made that is very, very important. As the President has pointed out often, we are in a global information economy and society in the 21st century that makes the educational level of our citizenry the single most important strategic asset for the country. And we also know that if you look at the demographics of that are already sort of baked in to our in our school population as they go through the grades, that in order for this country to once again regain educational preeminence, Latino achievement rates are going to have to increase substantially. And so that's why this is the reality behind the slogan that, you know, the Latino educational agenda is not just a problem for our community, but it is a national issue. Every American has a stake in the Latino community advancing its educational achievement and contributing to a better educated, more productive workforce, as well as an engaged citizenry for the 21st century. Now, the federal government has been doing its part, I believe, under the leadership of President Obama. And we have done, as far as higher education is concerned, two major accomplishments that were achieved in the first 2 years of this administration were, one, the transition to 100% direct lending. This was, in the past, federal student aid loans for students were routed in great part through the banking sector, which basically received a guarantee and a subsidy from the federal government. And this basically cost us about $8 billion a year. And when the government decided to switch to direct lending, which was really a policy that had been striven for ever since the Clinton administration, but we finally succeeded in doing it under the Obama administration, we are in fact saving $8 billion a year. And that additional money can go to provide more Pell Grants for students. And the Pell Grant program itself has, in fact, dramatically increased. The number of Pell Grant awards that are being made has increased very substantially. And we are on track to keep the maximum Pell Grant award at now the next scheduled amount would be about around $5,600 a year. So these are two bedrock commitments by the administration that we will stick by. There is also, as I mentioned, the Race to the Top program for higher ed in the 2013 budget proposal. There's another program that I'm particularly fond of that's being proposed that would run under FIPSE, under the Fund for the Improvement of Postsecondary Education, which is a program that runs in through my office, and that's called First in the World. And this program would start small. It's only about $55 million the first year. Hopefully it will grow after it shows its impact. But this program would basically be targeted at institutions, unlike the Race to the Top, which is targeted to states. would be targeted to institutions of higher education, and we'll be looking for proposals to promote innovation in higher education. Innovation in teaching and learning pedagogies, innovation in the use of technology, designed to improve the effectiveness of higher education as well as the efficiency of it. Because we do have an affordability problem in higher education right now. This is the new buzzword when talking about higher ed in Washington is affordability. And I think you know what I'm talking about because the recent developments in California have really shone a spotlight on it. And I'm talking about the fact that most public institutions are being forced to raise their tuition and fees to compensate for cutbacks in state funding. So this is a problem, and the president has framed the issue under the heading of shared responsibility. How are we going to handle or address the affordability problem? It's a shared responsibility, and the three institutions, the three sectors that have to work at it are first the federal government, which we are doing by the support for student financial aid, and with programs like Race to the Top for Higher Ed. And then colleges have a responsibility to look for ways to become more efficient. And I hesitate to tell you this because I know that the Cal State system is probably already among the most efficient in the country. But there is there's still untapped potential in the technologies that are emerging now. We have the ability. There are some examples of excellence and innovation with the use of technology. I'm thinking primarily of Carnegie Mellon and its Open Learning Initiative. We have the ability to use technology in completely different ways that will actually allow us to automate certain aspects of the learning process. For example, having interactive tutorials for students that are computer-based, that are based on artificial intelligence, and can provide individualized tutorial feedback to students. And that way, we can then concentrate the faculty time on the highly interactive, personalized mentoring that is the most valuable role that faculty play with students. And so there's also lots of other things that universities are already doing in terms of achieving efficiencies in their business functions. So all of these things need to be worked on, and that's the share of responsibility that colleges face. The third one, though, and it's a big one, is state responsibility. State responsibility for supporting higher education at adequate levels. And so we're doing our part with the Race to the Top program. We're hoping to create incentives there for states by looking at the experience we had in the Race to the Top for K-12, where I would say that the success has been quite remarkable because the funding that was made available prompted a lot of states to develop fairly far-reaching comprehensive reform plans. Only a certain number of states, it was a very competitive process, only a certain number of states got the funding. Many other states that didn't get the funding developed such good plans that they went ahead and they implemented them anyway. So it really triggered a lot of change across the country and helped leverage the federal money into greater resource allocation and reform. So we're hoping that we can do something similar to that with higher education. And among, there are a number of things that we're hoping states will do, such as improve articulation between the different levels of education, between the transfers between colleges, between community colleges and four-year institutions. Also, adoption of standards, college and career-ready standards for high school, so that students that come to college don't need remediation, because remediation takes, it forces institutions, four-year institutions, to put resources into those courses that they could be putting on the credit-bearing courses. So it would help with the productivity and the capacity of the four-year institutions if the students came college-ready from the get-go. So that's another important piece. And finally, we would expect states to commit to a reasonable level, stable and reasonable level of support for public higher education as part of their Race to the Top proposal. So those are the things we're hoping to do on the federal side to encourage state continued support for public higher education. Coming from California as I do, I am, you know, it really pains me personally to see how the master plan for higher education is somewhat in tatters in the state. It was the basis for the prosperity of California and its golden age. It was bipartisan at the time. It started under the governorship of Earl Warren and continued under Pat Brown. There was a bipartisan commitment to developing the human and physical capital, the infrastructure in the state that would allow for a booming economy and a vibrant society. And we seem to have forgotten some of those lessons in the state. And and this brings me to Professor Garcia's point, which is that part of the reason for this is that we have right now quite a disparity between the population that has children in school and in college, and the electorate, the people who vote. The people who vote as a profile tend to be older than the population of the state as a whole. And so, and as was mentioned earlier, the missing piece is the Latino vote. So if you're a resident, get your citizenship. If you're a citizen, vote. It's very important that you vote and to have government be responsive and reflective of your needs and of the needs of society as a whole. So, as I said earlier, the secretary really was very good and very concise at communicating to you the things that we're doing to support Latino educational achievement and how important we think of it in this administration. So I'm not going to belabor that point. And in fact, I'm going to stop here and provide the most opportunity for a more interactive session and give the students a chance to ask some questions, and maybe we'll get to the audience after that. So.
Thank you, Dr. Ochoa, for this very informative speech that highlights the very important issues that are facing our students in post-secondary education. At this time, he's going to remain standing at the podium. We are going to have questions from our student panel. After our panelists get an opportunity to ask their questions, we will extend the invitation to our live audience as well as to our online community audience. But we're going to go ahead and start, and we're going to start our question with Mr. Christian Diaz.
Okay. Thank you for the introduction, Mr. Gomez. Good morning, Dr. Ochoa. Thank you for being with us here today.
Morning.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. As Mr. Gomez stated, my name is Christian Diaz. I am a kinesiology major here at Cal State San Bernardino, and my topic is college affordability. How do we ensure that by making college more affordable, we don't sacrifice the quality? Also, how is the department planning on reducing tuition costs or offering more aid for those who really need it?
Well, this is a very important question. There have been some concerns in the higher education community, and I'm very sensitive to this, having been a provost until just less than 2 years ago, that with all of the emphasis on graduation rates and graduation numbers and getting the completion numbers up, that we would, by focusing so much on quantity, that we would lose track of quality. So this is a very important issue, and it's one that, it's interesting because this issue came up in a different context. It really brought it home. One of the things that has created some controversy, I'm going to bring up an issue here that you didn't mention, and everybody's been too polite to mention so far, but I'll mention it. One of the regulations that we developed in the department has given some headaches to higher education, and that's something called the credit hour rule, which is a rule that was developed that actually stipulates what federal financial aid pays for. And it basically pays for the number of credits that students are enrolled in. And we went ahead and actually defined the credit hour because our inspector general pointed out that we didn't have any definition. Nowhere was it written down in federal law or statute or regulation what it was we were actually giving $150 billion a year for. And the problem came to a head with one particular institution, for-profit institution, which played fast and loose with the definition, and we felt, you know, that was not appropriate. But when you look at it, right now, even after we adopted the definition of credit hour, which is the conventional one, the Carnegie unit, which is basically links it to seat time, you're really, what happens during that seat time? Just putting in the time in the classroom doesn't guarantee that there's quality there either. How do you know if you have quality? So the quality question is an even more fundamental one. Even if we didn't have this big emphasis on number of graduates, and we continued our traditional way by focusing on seat time as the measure of learning, that's really an input. How much time you put in the classroom is what you put into it, but what is coming out in terms of outcomes is still a question. And it's a question that is really fundamental and higher education needs to address. Now, and we have been trying to work at it. There has been a movement for a number of years to assess as well as to define learning outcomes. The American Association of Colleges and Universities has developed a very useful set of learning outcomes, general educational outcomes, called the LEAP Learning Outcomes. And there's also been support by the Lumina Foundation for something called the Degree Qualifications Profile, which is inspired in part by what's been going on in Europe under the Bologna process, where actually academics from across the continent actually got together and developed, first they developed a kind of a uniform definition for degrees, which they didn't have. We have it. We have associates, bachelors, masters, PhDs, and they all have a certain amount of time associated with them. In Europe, they had different, you know, incompatible systems. So first they caught up to us by developing a uniform structure like we have, but then they went beyond us by actually articulating using rubrics, using words to describe what somebody with each of those degree levels should be expected to know and be able to do, which is something we haven't actually done in a uniform way in this country. I'm giving you a long answer because you really raised a very big question, the question of quality. And I think that that's a question that we're very interested in actually fostering, and I'd be happy to entertain any ideas from the academics in the room, how they think we might be able to help foster and stimulate and facilitate higher education coming together and actually developing an alternative to the credit hour defined in terms of seat time as a way of specifying quality. What is a quality education? What does it entail? If we have that, then why do we need that? How does that tie in with affordability? Well, if you don't have quality well-defined, and there's pressure to reduce costs, what's going to happen? Bigger classes, more multiple choice tests, a diluting of the quality of education, which since we're not measuring, won't really show up. It won't be very visible. On the other hand, if we specify, articulate very clearly what a quality educational outcome is, and we develop ways to actually measure it, then if we don't meet that standard, we will know, because we're measuring it. So that would be a safety net against the quality being reduced. Now, how to actually accomplish a reduction in costs and making a college more affordable is, I think, and I would tie that back to something I alluded to earlier, which is we have, like every other industry, we can tap the potential that technology has to reduce costs while maintaining quality. Other industries have done it. Higher education hasn't done it as well. We have tended to focus, as faculty, we see technology as something that can help us do more things. We don't necessarily think about how can we reinvent or re-envision how we do some of the things we're currently doing differently with technology. I actually, you know, maybe it's my engineering background, but I think that there's a lot of potential there, and we've been able to do it in other industries. If we find a way to direct our faculty's creativity and inventiveness to the objective of not only improving quality, but also improving efficiency, I think we would get extraordinary results. We're already getting it here and there. As I mentioned, Carnegie Mellon is a prime example of an area where they're working on that. I think we could get, you know, that's one of the things I'm hoping that First in the World, the program under FIPSI, will do, is it will help spur innovation that actually makes us more productive. And one last point I'll make here, this is not about, replacing faculty with computers, because we have to increase the capacity of our educational system. So we need all the faculty we have, but we need them to be able to do more than they're able to do now without just simply working harder. We need to be more productive, inherently more productive, and I think that there's great potential here. So I'm sorry for that long answer, but you really touched the button.
Thank you, Christian. Our next question is from Lupita Riesa. Lupita, please tell us a little bit about yourself. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and good morning, Dr. Ochoa. My name is Maria Riestra, and I'm a fourth year here at Cal State San Bernardino, and I will be obtaining my degree in communications. And what I wanted to ask you were your thoughts on the Student Loan Forgiveness Act of 2012, which was recently proposed. And from my understanding, this act would allow students who pursue their undergraduate and graduate degrees to potentially have their student loan debt waived if they were to make payments of 10% of their monthly income for 10 years. So my question for you, Dr. Ochoa, is this something that the U.S. Department of Education supports? And do you think it's reasonable?
Yes, the answer is yes, we do support it. We think that it's a very worthwhile thing. I will say beyond this legislation, which would be good, and I think that the president has actually come out in favor of it as well, the fact of the matter is that the earnings premium for a college graduate now, the difference in lifetime earnings of a college graduate compared to someone with high school or less, has gotten bigger than ever. And so, as an economist, I can't resist saying, well, if you look at that stream of higher lifetime earnings and you apply a discount rate to the present value of that and compare it with that, what you would have to borrow, actually, it's a good deal. It's a good investment. And I know that this is very difficult, particularly for first-generation to college students, students from low-income backgrounds who are made very nervous by debt. The reality is that higher education remains a very, very good investment in terms of the rate of return and lifetime earnings. But certainly this legislation would make it possible for even more students to go to college and to help us achieve our educational goals, so definitely.
Excellent question, Lupita. And I know that in our community here in San Bernardino, having and facing debt is a major, major issue for a lot of our parents, and working with parents in San Bernardino City Unified, we acknowledge that this is a concern that sometimes really discourages parents from motivating their students to go to college. So I think that was an excellent question, and thank you for your response. Our next student panelist is Carlo Ludwig.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Carlo Ludwig, currently pursuing a degree in political science, and this is my senior year. My question to you, Dr. Ochoa, is some people are concerned about moving public funds to virtual schools instead of investing in the public education system. What are your thoughts on virtual education, and how will virtual education be tailored to serve special education students?
So by virtual education, do you mean distance learning type schools? Yeah. Distance learning is a technology that has its place, and it can help supplement traditional education. And I have to, there are several different strands here. One is the use of distance learning by traditional institutions. I think we have found that the so-called hybrid mode of delivery, where students do some in-class studying and some online learning, works very well. And so to that extent, to the extent that distance learning is used as a delivery method to supplement traditional instruction, it can actually help, in fact, raise the capacity of institutions. For example, if an institution literally has run out of physical space to deliver classes, if you were to convert a class so that it meets half the time face-to-face and half of the other time of the time online, you actually have double the capacity of the physical space by doing that. So you're able to offer more classes. So that's one good use of it. There are also programs, again, offered by traditional higher education institutions of known quality that are accredited, longstanding, that are offering some of their programs fully online. For example, Sonoma State University, as a matter of fact, is offering a fully online nursing program, which is they're able to reach students in the remote parts of Northern California that wouldn't be able to come to the campus, and that's working out quite well. So those are all good uses. Now, what some people, there's a third sort of element here, which I think is what may be giving some people concern, which is purely online institutions that have been created, from scratch, and many of them for profit, who are looking at it as a business opportunity, and so this raises the whole question. Really, it's not so much the distance learning aspect of it, I would say, as the for profit character of the institution that is that potentially a problem, and we have had that problem. There has been, a number of documented cases of students that are not well served by for-profit institutions, but there are others who do a better job, even though they're for-profit. So the key here is that when you have a for-profit form of organization, the incentives and the risks for the institution not doing what you hope that they will do are different than for a traditional nonprofit university. A nonprofit university, if there isn't a strong institutional culture of service to students, can sometimes also be somewhat dysfunctional if it's too focused on the internal needs, of the faculty and staff, and they're not student-oriented enough. And so there may be a lack of concern with student success, et cetera. So those are the ways that that kind of institution can go wrong. A for-profit university, where things can go wrong, is where the profit motive finds a way to achieve itself by ways other than delivering value to the student. So you have potential for dysfunctionality, and they're different. And the other problem with the for-profits is that also the for-profit motivation means that there's a built-in desire to grow. Growth is a strong driver in a for-profit institution, as opposed to a nonprofit, which sometimes actually may be driven by the desire for prestige, which means they have to limit their growth and make themselves more selective and get themselves up in the rankings. That's another way of going wrong, not serving students well. But it's different. And so with the for-profits, we run into the problem that some bad actors, as the Secretary Duncan has described them, are achieving their phenomenal growth, and they're tapping into federal financial aid for most of the revenue by not serving the students well. And so this is a problem. But I would say that it's not so much a problem of distance learning per se, although that's it's a popular vehicle for for-profit institutions. The problem is with the for-profit set of incentives and how that requires a different set of oversights and regulation than a traditional nonprofit. In the traditional nonprofit sector, we have relied on accreditation, on peer review as a way of ensuring quality. In the for-profit sector, we have found that that system of accreditation is having difficulty handling the issues that are raised with for-profit institutions, and that's why the department and my office specifically has had to develop a number of regulations for programs that are so-called leading to gainful employment, where we have tried to tap into some indirect measures of quality by looking at, by making, requiring them to achieve certain levels, desirable levels of debt repayment rate by their graduates, and by keeping their debt-to-income ratio of their graduates within reasonable levels. We think that if those programs are of good quality, and if those students therefore are going to employment that pays them reasonably well, they'll repay their loans, and their debt-to-income ratio won't be out of sync. And so by looking at those indirect measures, we are getting some sense of whether their programs are of quality or not. So.
Thank you, Dr. Ochoa. Our last question from our student panelists, and we have about, I think, about 5 to 7 minutes. It will be Maritza Morales. And then we're going to take our questions to our online community as well as to our live audience.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. And good morning. Thank you for having, like, being here with us. My name is Maritza Morales. I am a third year here at CSUSB, and I am studying psychology and human development with an emphasis in child development. My question to you is, as Assistant Secretary of the Department of Education, what is your belief about community from a national and local perspective? What elements keep you in touch with the students and the needs of the students? And how are you making yourself more approachable in a more direct way to the students?
That's a tough one. Well, one way is by coming to events like these, yeah. Visiting campuses. Yeah, it is a great way to stay connected. I always feel good coming to a campus. Washington is a exciting but tough environment. You heard Secretary Duncan also say he wishes he was here. So that's very helpful. We're trying to develop better ways to communicate with all of our stakeholders in our Office of Post-Secondary Education. We're going to start, we have a Twitter account now, and we're working on Facebook and all other social media. So we hope to be able to stay in touch with people that way. Yeah. But the best way is to come and see you all face to face and sort of get recharged for the battle.
Excellent. At this time, if anyone here in the audience has any questions for Dr. Ochoa, we do have a microphone in the middle of the aisle. Please come up.
Mi pregunta es la siguiente. Usted mencionó que darán más dinero para las comunidades en desventaja económica. Mas mi pregunta es, ¿quién monitoreará que estos dineros realmente sean usados con equidad? Mi petición es la siguiente. Que nos den talleres específicos en cómo saber navegar en el sistema académico y entender los resultados de lo siguiente, los benchmarks que se le hacen a nuestros hijos de EL y educación regular a nivel elementaria cada 3 semanas, y sucesivamente los resultados del CST, el STAR Test, el CELM, AMAO, que son los niveles de lenguaje, que miden el nivel de lenguaje de artes del inglés y matemáticas, ya que sin estos conocimientos, ¿cómo podemos trabajar en equipo como padres, maestros y estudiantes y incrementar la educación para cerrar la brecha? Nuestro distrito escolar, para graduar a nuestros niños, le pide que pasen con 1.0 cada materia curricular, cuando la mayoría de los distritos pide un 2.0.
Can we have a translation for that question, please? A summation of that question in English so that our English participants can understand that question.
Okay.
And we have a translator who's going to be coming up at this point. But Dr. Ochoa, you also are bilingual,
the question and answer it as well. Muchas gracias por su pregunta, señora. The question basically has fairly detailed questions and requests, primarily dealing with K-12 and a number of tests and expectations of students in the K-12 system that deal with English language learners. And so this is not, unfortunately, my field of expertise because I'm in higher education, but I am very interested in giving you an answer. So what I would do is I would like to take that information with me, and consult my colleagues who work in K-12 and actually get that back to you as well, so we can exchange information. Así que lo que voy a hacer es si me da toda la información, yo la voy a llevar conmigo al departamento. Y voy a contactar mis colegas que trabajan en el sector de K-12, porque yo, mi especialidad es el nivel postsecundario. Pero quiero obtener respuestas para las preguntas que me ha hecho. Entonces, si me da toda la información, yo contacto a mis colegas y nos ponemos en contacto con usted.
Gracias. Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question. If you can please state your name and ask Dr. Ochoa our question.
Hi, my name is Guadalupe Gamiz, and I am a third master's a student and also a candidate for a doctorate in educational reform. And tied to that connection, because I've been an educator for 13 years in the K-12 system, quality and need and learning for a purpose. There's a lot of needs. I'm tired of theory in the class. Great theories, great ideas, but not applicable to the real life in the real world. We have major problems like that in our Title I schools. Accountability. Where is the accountability? I think we need to backwards map here, take into consideration human performance technology, and to a certain extent, HR. Where are we in this accountability? And you know what? We have the technology now, transparency. Maybe people watching now can make a difference in our schools that are suffering and putting the students in the place of need, not thinking about all this great theory in the classroom, but actually servicing the communities and actually partnering up with them. You talked about the service and community service. Trade schools have been doing it, but they've been excluded. This exclusion-inclusion thing, now we need to collaborate because we're all trying to do the same thing, which is provide somebody with the training needed where there's a need either in corporate America or in service sector. So my question is, what are you going to be doing about that accountability piece and the auditing piece to make sure that everybody's being held accountable to that measurement?
And that will be our last question, and this will be our final response from Dr. Ochoa.
Well, this is something that is very, very important to Secretary Duncan, accountability, transparency. We are, just for starters, in post-secondary, we are developing right now with White House leadership, a scoreboard that will provide clear, understandable information to parents and students when they're trying to pick a university in terms of, you know, what are the graduation rates in those schools, how well are the students doing when they graduate in terms of, you know, work. So all of that in terms of making college more transparent. Then connecting it to the other part of it is we have a new, my colleague Brenda Dan Messier, who is the Assistant Secretary for the Office of Vocational and Adult Education. She's developed a new sort of model for career and technical education that's going to be launched. And that's going to inform all of our grant programs to really bring that back to the mainstream of education. And one of the features would be, for example, the idea of stackable credentials, which we saw a little bit in the telenovela, which showed, you know, the little page that the student showed her father, showed that there were these steps that you could start on a very technical certificate, but that feeds into an associate, and that feeds into a bachelor, and so on. So there's a connection between all of those levels of education. And then in terms of teacher preparation, that is an area that the Secretary is very passionate about. He believes every student deserves to have an excellent teacher, have access to an excellent teacher, and it is an extremely important thing for him is to, you know, he cannot abide the notion that a segment of our children are simply, you know, shortchanged from the get-go. They never have a chance because they go to a poor school that sets them back. So that's something that we're you know, our programs are definitely working on. And there's Race to the Top. Early Challenge is another, early education is another program that's going to try to, you know, drill deeper and earlier into that process So, you know, if you have any specific ideas, and I heard you mention a couple, I'll give you my card. I'd be glad to share them with my colleagues, and we're open to all kinds of input.
Thank you, Dr. Cho. At this time, I do want to thank our student panelists for some outstanding questions that they asked. I would also like to thank Dr. Ochoa. Thank you for your dedication to our students and working in this very important position. And at this time, I would like to redirect the program to Dr. Murillo.
Okay, thank you. With much gratitude, Assistant Secretary Ochoa and panelists. Thank you. And let's do it again. Come on, another. Okay.
Well, we hope that you've enjoyed the discussion. It was actually a very interesting discussion. We had numerous individuals. In fact, Dr. Ernest Garcia talked about, started out the discussion early on, and talked about the civil responsibility that we have.
Yes.
You know, all of us, whether it's in the United States or internationally, just the civil responsibility that we have. And he talked about voting. And for a moment, you know, I thought, okay, well, what's the connection? Well, the connection is very important, because once we're able to vote, we have more of a say in terms of what's happening. And when it comes to education, we certainly want the federal government to be involved. And then, of course, the last discussion that we had the assistant director to the Department of Education, Eduardo Ochoa, and there were numerous questions that were asked of him that were quite interesting. Some very detailed questions talking about programs. I was impressed that he said that he oversees about 60 programs on a federal level.
Yeah, a lot going on. As you can see, this is a live event. Everybody, you know, anything can happen. It's unedited, uncut. But yeah, you know, and then we had the video, right? We had the video at the very beginning. Kind of, you know, talks about the mentality. Sometimes we have to change the mentality of some, even parents or
Absolutely.
Some thinking. And I like, you know, how the gentleman came in and said, listen to her, encourage her. In fact, I think we have with us the... hi, how are you doing?
Hello.
That was a great video, Andres.
Thank you.
Now, Andres, for our audience, how did that come to you? How did that project come exactly to you?
Well, we were contacted by Santa Ana Community College, and they were interested in promoting STEM, and they wanted an innovative way that... could speak to Latino parents, and we were fortunate enough to meet them here at this LEAD conference last year.
Well, is that how it happened?
Yeah, that's so how it happened. Yeah,
you got connected with them.
Complete networking.
Now, talk to us, because you your company. What is it that your company does?
Our company is called Novelas Educativas, and we take you know, research. We take ideas and we translate them into a narrative format. A novella, and with actors and a movie set, we create these stories that people can relate to, especially Latinos.
You brought up the video brings up a very important point. We're talking about educators and we're talking about the school system, but the video touches on families, and so it's not only changing the perspective of educators, but changing the perspective of family members, where you have generations that are accustomed to a certain way of life and expecting certain things from our children, and not necessarily because they didn't have those opportunities, they don't necessarily foresee them for their children, and they don't see that there are certain things are attainable, really. Yeah. And so I thought it was great how this young lady has all these dreams and all these things she wants to accomplish, and trying to persuade her father that, no, it is possible, and this is a good thing what I'm doing.
Absolutely. The biggest influence that our children have, it's not TV, it's not their friends, it's the parents.
Yes.
And parents, once the parents are given information, and they're the greatest advocates for education. So, yeah, you know, these tools... These education tools are for parents to get dialogue started with their children, with their young children, and we've had really good success with them.
Yeah. Now we're also going to have you later. Stay tuned, because we're going to have you later in another panel talking about technology.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well. Yeah. I'm going to be on a panel at 2:00 California time, and what we're going to be doing is. you know, technology, it's tied into what we do, because right. that's our, we develop content, we have to deliver that content. And that content is being delivered through what, you know, the
online,
web,
viral, yeah. yeah. Which again has no boundaries. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. Wow. And there's so many things that, that still have to, remain the same when it comes to technology in respect to storytelling. But, there are things that are changing in respect to technology. So, it's, you know, story's been around for, you know, hundreds of years. And, so how do we continue to develop great content, but find new ways to deliver that content?
Now, how can people find you online?
Well, we're at novelaseducativas.com. Very simple, novelaseducativas.com. And yeah, you can send us an email through there, and we're really good about getting back to people. So I'll probably answer it personally, or my brother will, my brother Miguel Orozco.
Awesome. Well, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll see you at 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you
very
much.
Very
much.
So as you can see, again, some, you know, a storyteller takes it. And again, the networking part that happened here at the Latino Education Advocacy Days last year led to this year's video. That was pretty surprising. I didn't know that.
Well, that's what's great, because I would think that each year you have new people coming in with new ideas that will just lead to better programming for the following year's right. event.
Now, we do want to remind our online viewers that, as you can see, we had a lot of questions here. They lined up, actually. Yeah. And we're kind of stressing because we don't see any questions at first. And then you guys put in your questions, and we thank you for that. We're sorry we didn't get to all of them. In fact, we wanted to get...
Director of Education, Eduardo Ochoa.
Yeah, we want to get him over here, but he's being bombarded by everybody. so keep your questions coming. Here's the other thing. What happened, I think, in last year, it was interesting because someone from the White House actually came, but they were looking at the Twitter feed, they were looking at the live stream feed, and they were watching it as well. And then they answered it in their public address. So it's interesting. You never know who's watching online. We also got some great Twitter people using the hashtag LEAD. We got a picture from one of the audience
yes.
members here. That was pretty neat. Again, come and check us out at livestream.com/LSAC National. Share this, and we want to hear your thoughts and your questions.
Yes, please continue sharing. I know that we've seen already a number of participants. I believe we had Connecticut being
yes.
represented. Texas is represented. So thank you so much. We're glad that you're watching. And we hope that you're taking something away from the discussions that are taking place. They're obviously very in-depth conversations, things that we hope will help, you know, your universities. And perhaps, you know, create a dialogue, you know, amongst all of you. Maybe perhaps things that are taking place in your schools that you want to change. Please share with us things that are working for all of you.
Yes.
As Aaron said, you know, it's not only the dialogue they're having with us, but others are viewing some of your questions and comments as well. So you could make an impact on, you know, on what happens in, you know, I guess in the state of our educational system.
Absolutely. Oh, we have the man of the hour. We were just talking about you. Thank you for coming on.
Hello, my pleasure.
Now, you spoke about a lot of very important things. In fact, there's questions we didn't even get to because, I'm sure you get bombarded like that a lot.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of fun. It's exciting. And all of these issues are interconnected. So one question prompts a lot of other associations. That's why I went on a little too long on some of the earlier questions.
We know we're running late, but we wanted to fit in as much as we could, right?
Well, if you don't mind me interrupting you, Aaron,
no, please.
I know you talked about state responsibility, and I thought that was so important, but how do we hold states accountable for what they're doing when it comes to the educational system?
Well, I think that Dr. Garcia really hit the nail on the head. The vote is fundamentally what's. I mean, this is a problem in California that we've had for some time, which is the disconnect between the profile of the electorate and the profile of families who have children in school. And so you have people voting who don't identify with the students in the school, and so they're not motivated to support that kind of funding. So the only way out of that impasse is for the Latino community to make a big push to have much greater voter participation. And so their numbers will then speak volumes.
Yeah, I do have a question from the online audience, from Professor Itza Harel in the Department of Languages and Literature. And his question was, can you share how the Department of Education is addressing adult education among the Latino population?
Well, I think that, as I mentioned at the end there, we are working on a new model of for career and technical education that is going to, you know, embody the latest research and understanding of the best practices. My colleague Brenda Dan Messier is an expert in this area. She's been leading the effort, and it's going to be much more 21st century oriented. It's going to provide adults with the skills they need to operate in this information economy. And it's also going to provide them with a foundation that gives them the option of then going on to get actual degrees, not only certificates, you know, vocational
certificates. About that being online?
Well, it could be online, it could be in person, but it's fundamentally about the design of the curriculum.
Yeah.
And the connection with employers, too.
Dr. Ochoa, as you know, we're being seen online, not only within the United States, but across the country. In Argentina is being represented, Colombia, Cuba, Chile, Nicaragua, Panama. What message do you want to convey to everyone that's online? But I'm curious, what's the connection internationally? Because obviously education is a subject matter that's important to everyone, you know, across the border.
So can I answer that question in Spanish?
Of course.
Okay, a mis colegas a través de toda Latinoamérica, un saludo muy cordial. Y creo que su presencia en este programa es realmente una cosa muy positiva. Yo siempre he pensado que los latinos en Estados Unidos somos un puente para este país con toda América Latina. Hay una comunidad de intereses en nuestro gran continente de las Américas que tenemos que desarrollar. Así que estoy muy, muy excitado. Me excita mucho ver que esta conferencia LEAD los haya incluido a ellos.
Muchas gracias, Dr. Ochoa.
Thank you, thank you. And thank you so very much for being a part of this. Oh, you said you had a Twitter. What was that about? You have a Twitter, or the department has a Twitter?
I've got a Twitter account. The department has one, too.
Do you want people following you?
Sure.
what is it?
It's. I think it's EM Ochoa 50.
You probably have like 20 different ones all pretending to be you, but you got it. You heard it right here. Ian Ochoa. Okay, we're going to go ahead and follow you here. Feel free to have fun in the discussion. Thank you again. Thanks for joining
Muchas
us.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you. Again, you're watching us live here at the California State University of San Bernardino, Latino Education Advocacy Days. We'll be right back.